Hello, and welcome to the Reason Roundtable Podcast. I'm Peter Suderman, filling in for Matt Welch, who is researching names of 1970s baseball players that don't actually exist. Happy Monday. Today, I am joined by my regular co-panelists, Catherine Mangu Ward and Nick Gillespie, as well as special guest, senior editor and Reason Roundup lead author, Elizabeth Nolan Brown. Everybody say hi.
Howdy.
Hey, Peter.
Hi.
Hi, everyone. So today we are going to talk about President Joe Biden's calamitous first year and the new antitrust crusade on Capitol Hill. We are also going to hear a reader question about a potential hiccup with school choice. But before that, a word from a sponsor. This episode of the Reason Roundtable is supported by The Long Time Academy, a new podcast about how to be a good ancestor. It's a show about time and how we think about time. Short-term thinking can be stressful. Some of us find it difficult to plan for tomorrow or next week, let alone next year or 10 years from now or the end of this podcast. Long-term thinking can help. If you've ever felt unproductive, exhausted, or worried about the future, anxious about the news, powerless to change the path our world is on, the Longtime Academy can help. You'll hear from people like Brian Eno, Celeste Headlee, George the Poet, Roman Kersnerak, Jay Griffiths, and Adrienne Marie Brown, and learn how they embrace long-term thinking. The Longtime Academy is an audio documentary, but it also includes practical exercises designed to expand your sense of time and help you be a good ancestor. Personally, I just don't see how you could not be excited about a podcast that features Brian Eno and the nature of time, especially if you've ever listened to Taking Tiger Mountain. Life is short, time is long. The Longtime Academy. Search for The Longtime Academy anywhere you listen to podcasts. All right, since I'm hosting, we are going to bring back segment names, and I want to call this opening segment Joe-mentum with a question mark or three. So as of last week, Joe Biden has officially been president for one whole year. It either seems like a lot more than that or a lot less. And I want to talk about how that year has gone. By most metrics, I think it's fair to say not so well. Biden's approval rating has cratered. We have seen an unusual number of party switches from Democrat to Republican. Biden's agenda in Congress has stalled. The Supreme Court blocked the large employer vaccine mandates his administration tried to administer through OSHA. Inflation is surging to levels we haven't seen in about 40 years. COVID case rates are coming down, but are still exceptionally high. You can't buy chicken wings or PlayStations. And on the heels of all of this, it sure looks like Democrats are in for a tough time at the polls later this year. In response, Joe Biden has promised free rapid COVID tests to all Americans and free N95 face masks, both of which look like they will be available at just about the exact moment that the current surge in COVID cases ends. He also stood for a press conference last week that, at nearly 2 hours long, ended up actually being longer than the first 48 Hours film, the one with Eddie Murphy and Nick Nolte, if you guys remember that, in which he defended his administration and insisted that all in all, Team Biden had actually done a pretty good job. No one would be fired. No major course corrections would be considered. But he did say he planned to make several changes to his approach, all of which weirdly amounted to the same change. Biden said he was going to focus more on messaging. Americans, in his telling, just didn't understand what a good job Joe Biden and co. had done. And he was going to devote himself to educating them this coming year. Nick, I want to go to you first. What is it that normal people don't understand about how great Joe Biden's first year has gone?
Well, you know, the first thing, which I think it's really important to note, and this was true of Donald Trump in his first year, and it was true of Barack Obama and of Bill Clinton, and to a certain degree, George Bush, although he remained popular. These president and Ronald Reagan, for that matter, presidents who get to do most of what they run on almost always have terrible first years in office, because it turns out that people actually don't want what they you know, ran on and got elected on. Biden did pass, you know, basically a $2 trillion COVID relief package early and a $1 trillion infrastructure bill. And these ultimately were not that popular. It also, it turns out, and, you know, I think you've written about this, Peter, most people were not voting for Joe Biden as much as against Donald Trump. I mean, you know, the two parties, which, you know, comprise about it, each has about a third, you know, of solid support among the population, but the largest group are people who don't really give a shit for either party. And lately they've been voting against whatever party was just in office. So I think that Biden should be proud that he got a bunch of like what he ran on through, but the problem is that didn't work and it's not popular. And then there is a messaging question here, because every time he shows up, and especially at length, that, you know, that 2 hour press conference, the only thing it reminded me of was The Eternals, which is the shittiest Marvel movie of all time. And I think it's still going on. It never ended. Biden was like that. And it just confirmed to everybody that he's kind of out of it. He's not a sharp thinker. And he is not going to actually, you know, he's going to pretend to focus on messaging as opposed to the stuff that he has to adapt to and change. And he's not going to do that.
Catherine, I want to ask you actually about The Eternals. No.
I quit this podcast.
I don't know if you saw.
Really one of the worst movies, but watch the Biden press conference and suddenly it's not the worst kind
they
of
both
you know, superhero
movie. They
both
felt like they were never going to end. No, I don't know if you saw, Catherine, Democratic advisor, sort of longtime Democratic hand, Paul Begala, say last week that Democrats don't have bad leaders. They have bad followers. Basically, the problem is stupid voters who don't understand how great Democrats in Washington are actually doing. And so it seems to me like there's a refusal within the Democratic policy or sort of partisan political establishment to reckon with the party's policy failures. Democrats control the White House, the House, and the Senate. Now, it is a slim majority and their limitations as a result, but Democrats are the ones wielding power in Washington in a lot of ways, and yet they can't seem to get the public on board with their agenda. Is messaging going to fix that? Is there a course that they could take for the next year that would right the ship?
You know, there was a scandal back in the ancient days of the first Bush presidency when he said the quiet part loud and he said, message, I care. I am not actually old enough to remember that, but I have read about it. And, you know, I think it's weird that now that's like the absolute baseline standard of discourse is like message, colon, and then the message. And in this case, the message seems to be like message. Actually, you're wrong, which is makes like I care sound like politically savvy and in touch with the people. I mean, the idea that if reasonable people simply had all the information, if the right inputs had been put into their brains, they would clearly agree with the agenda of the sitting Democratic president is a plague on our politics. It is a major problem with the Democratic Party. Say what you want about Republicans, and boy howdy will I say what I want about Republicans.
Boy howdy.
They don't think everyone is secretly a Republican. And I think broadly, mainstream elected Democrats do seem to think everyone is secretly a Democrat if they just weren't so stupid and misinformed. And that's wrong. People have different preferences. They're going to disagree on fundamentals for good reasons. And Biden's refusal to acknowledge that has always been annoying to me. And I think, according to his approval ratings, it's annoying to many Americans.
Liz, so since Catherine brought up normal people who may or may not care and may have different preferences, I want to do some extremely statistically invalid political science here, which is to say I want to do some journalism and use you as a one-woman focus group. So for the last couple of years, you have been living in Ohio, one of the bellwether states in American politics. There's a reason that pollsters and mass market retail consultants spend a lot of time in the Columbus area. Ohio is, in its own way, the normiest state in America.
So, the heart of it all,
yeah, right?
According to its license plate.
So how is this stuff registering with normie America in Ohio? Are people excited about free rapid antigen tests being reimbursed by their insurers?
I mean, I'm partially a very bad model for this because basically the only people I've been seeing is my family, and they have that Midwestern quality where they resolutely just do not discuss politics at all. Like, we just don't discuss it. I feel like that's something actually like a lot of people around here have. Like,
you didn't sit around and talk about Joe Biden's press conference with your family at the dinner table last week?
We did not. But actually, there was a group text thread from my aunt, I won't say her name, who is my Trumpiest aunt, though. And she actually started the group text thread saying, like, look, here's where you can get free tests. So I guess my sample of, you know, my family says that they were excited about the Biden free test initiative and not like, what the heck, why are they doing this now? And why do we, you know, what is four tests going to do for us? And why can't the FDA approve them?
So, okay, so let's go back to Nick here. I do think, you know, in some ways we can be unfair, maybe not we on this podcast, but commentators can be unfair when talking about the president's, the president, the economy, sort of how those things relate, right? Some of this stuff is beyond the president's control. The president doesn't create jobs. The president isn't responsible for new COVID variants. And now that vaccines are available, the president may not actually be able to do all that much to change the course of the virus. Though it would be nice to hear the president acknowledge that.
Don't start using soft bigotry of low expectations now. You know, the president does matter. I agree with you. You know, they don't create jobs and they don't run the economy. But Biden campaigned on $11 trillion in new spending that he was going to pump in, you know, in his first term. And he did pass a couple of major funding bills, which I think people understand. And this is something I didn't foresee. People understand that when the government pumps massive amounts of money in a short time into the economy and you know, they're chasing the same amount of goods, that's a big contributing factor to inflation. So in that sense, Biden is partly responsible in the same way that the federal government is for the current inflation. So,
okay, I think that's totally fair. Policy plays a role here. And yet his agenda is stalled, and it's also doesn't seem to be obviously popular. Like the agenda he is trying to pass is not winning him support. So what policies should he be pursuing? Like, imagine you've got a minute with Joe Biden in the recent office elevator, which somehow is actually working. What do you pitch him on for a year two agenda?
You know, I think a year two agenda is actually kind of a cooling off period where instead of trying to pass exactly what he ran on and he can't, he has to, you know, recalibrate. I mean, this is also, I think this goes to the question of his competency and, you know, whether he's in reality or outside of it. When he was delivered the Senate, which he, you know, they shouldn't have won. The only reason the Democrats have a slim majority in the Senate is because Donald Trump was such a big fucking baby and couldn't admit that he lost the election and then ranted and then helped, you know, create conditions for the January 6th riot and whatnot, you know, so that the Republicans lost both seats in Georgia. You know, he needed to recalibrate. Like, he could have gotten Joe Manchin to basically do whatever he wanted if he had compromised within his party. I'm less interested, actually, in saying, okay, what should Joe Biden do in order to be more successful the second term? I think what I hope both parties are taking away from this is that there was a moment, and 2 years ago, a majority of people for the first time and basically as long as it's ever been polled by Gallup said they wanted the government, a majority of people wanted the government to do more things that individuals and businesses were doing. That reversed last year. People were freaked out by COVID. That was a moment where the government could do whatever it did. And, you know, under Trump's last year, full year, they spent $6.6 trillion over the past year, fiscal 2021, they spent $6.8 trillion, 50% more than we spent in 2019. That window is shut because people realize now, I think, that government doing more and spending more is not going to fix things. So I would argue, you know, the first thing that should happen is a kind of cooling off period and say, okay, what are the things that we should not be doing? That would be my, libertarian talking point to Joe Biden.
Can I harangue Joe Biden in the elevator too?
Yeah, do it.
Okay, so here's the thing. I agree he probably shouldn't do what he campaigned on, although there are a few things that people believed he campaigned on that I would love to see him do, like not basically duplicate Trump's immigration policy. But if I had Joe Biden in the elevator, I think the very specific pitch that I would make him is to use his pardon power. We have a tradition that presidents don't use their pardon power in the first year. I don't know why. That's stupid.
We're past the first year now.
Right. So Biden, in his first year, issued two pardons. They were for peanut butter and jelly, the Thanksgiving turkeys. Donald Trump issued...
Not the sandwich?
No, that doesn't need pardoning. It is perfect and will brook no criticism.
Man, Trump, fourth grade me with my lunchbox really disagrees.
Oh, no. PB&J is the bomb. Okay,
please,
but Trump
don't
issued,
tell us what the lunchbox was, Peter.
Who was on your lunchbox? Yeah. I want to know. What character?
Obviously, it was Star Wars.
Okay. Trump issued three pardons. The three pardons were the two turkeys and also... Arizona ex-sheriff Joe Arpaio, when Trump is out pardoning you in the sense that he managed to find the worst person in America to pardon, you should be ashamed of yourself. This is a thing Biden could be doing. This is like, even in his Nick imposed cooling off period, he could be doing pardons and he should be.
So Liz,
If I may just also, you know, one of the things that is getting a lot of play now today, I saw on Twitter and elsewhere, is that, you know, Joe Biden didn't try to unify, you know, the country, et cetera. And people are like, well, you know, the Republicans refuse to negotiate, refuse to do anything, which simply is not true. I mean, they are political opponents. They are willing when, you know, when the money is being spent the way they want to, they're more than willing to sign off on stuff. You know, they did it under Trump and they'll do it under Biden. And in fact, the infrastructure bill had some Republican votes to get it across the finish line. It would actually be fascinating to see a president. Because Obama didn't do this. George Bush didn't. You know, George Bush, W. Bush ushered in an era of you're with us or against us in the global war on terror. And that became political truth. You know, you are either with the Republicans or you're against them. You're with the Democrats or against them. Barack Obama talked about bitter clingers and drove a wedge between two parties. Trump obviously did that. Biden, it would be fascinating to see him actually try to do something where he woos Republicans. You know, it might not work, or something, you know, rather than just kind of blame, you know, there are not enough Democrats and the Republicans are all troglodytes and things like that.
So since you bring up bipartisanship here, that's actually a good opportunity to move on to our next topic. And because no one can stop me, we're going to call this segment Antitrust But Verify. So last week, the American Innovation and Choice Online Act, an antitrust bill targeting tech companies, masterminded by noted Salad Fork user Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, passed a Senate committee vote after a markup hearing that was pretty messy, but also revealing in certain ways. Even some Democratic lawmakers at the hearing seemed to think the bill was just a barely veiled attack on a handful of large tech companies. Senator Dianne Feinstein, a Democrat of California, said the legislation is specifically designed to target a small number of specific companies, most of which are headquartered in my home state. It's difficult, she said, to see the justification for a bill that regulates the behavior of only a handful of companies while allowing everyone else to continue engaging in that exact same behavior. So Liz Nolan Brown, you have been writing about antitrust quite a bit for us. Give us a rundown, some highlights from the hearing. What is this bill about? Why is this happening now? And since you wrote a great cover story for us last year on how antitrust is being wielded against large tech companies over the last couple of years, help us understand how this fits into the antitrust push that has been going on now for several years on Capitol Hill, and that has been garnering some bipartisan support.
Yeah, so the main thing about this bill that passed the Senate Judiciary Committee last week is that it would ban self-preferencing for covered platforms. And self-preferencing...
Okay, can you explain that to us?
Yes. Self-preferencing is like, you know, if Amazon has its own line, Amazon has its own line of products, Amazon Basics. They couldn't put those higher in search results or offer, you know, special things, maybe like free shipping, whatever. They couldn't do things to its own products that it's not letting other products do. There's a lot of ways that this could play out. I'll get into some of those in a second. But basically, the reason this bill is so weird is that, you know, most of the time, historically, antitrust law has targeted specific behaviors and in the interest of protecting consumer welfare. And this bill sort of does away with those planks. Instead of, you know, banning a behavior for being anti-competitive, regardless of who's doing it, it only does it if companies are online platforms with a certain amount of share or monthly users. So it was specifically written in a way to target basically four companies: Apple, Amazon, Facebook, and Google. And recently they you know, made an amendment to add Tencent, which is behind WeChat, and ByteDance behind TikTok. But so basically it's been written in a way so it just applies to these big tech companies. And so if other companies do the same behaviors that these big companies are doing, it's okay. It's not targeting illegal behaviors. It's targeting these companies. And then the other thing is that, you know, it's not doing this in order.
So when Walmart, for example, sells Walmart brand Cheerios, which I have to say, generic Cheerios, always bad.
I believe, isn't that Great Value is their house brand? which is they have a wonderful house brand.
They have a bunch of house brands, right? But like Walmart yeah, brand.
Big fan of the men's clothing line George.
Like on an end cap would be fine, but Amazon doing the same thing, not. Or the digital version of the same thing.
Correct. And certain things that, you know, like other search engines could display, Google couldn't. Google couldn't, you know, put its own maps. You know, if you click on a restaurant and it'll show you the restaurant and then it'll give you the option to just click on Google Maps to use that. I mean, that could ban things like Apple preloading its phones with its own apps, things that consumers really like that are convenient, that make our lives easier, that make us not have to do extra steps when we're doing things and that no one is complaining about. No one is like, oh man, like the Google Map was seamlessly there when I wanted to find a restaurant. And so these are the kind of things it would ban. And so that's why it's kind of getting away from this thing about consumer welfare. One of Chuck Grassley's aides even said, if we make carve-outs for all the pro-consumer features, then the bill will be useless. So they sort of have just been admitting that this isn't about protecting consumers from things that they don't want, from anti-competitive behavior, from, you know, higher prices or anything like that. It's basically about punishing tech companies and or, you know, increasing competition is what they say, but they just want to increase competition for its own sake, not for any particular purpose, not by showing that these companies are a monopoly, not by showing that, you know, people are being harmed by them. And it really fits in with what we've seen for the past year or so in regards to antitrust policy. It's kind of become the big thing, like you mentioned, Peter, on both sides with Republicans and Democrats, just sort of both wanting to use it as a cudgel to punish certain disfavored companies. For Republicans, it's all about they want to punish tech companies because they're mad about like people getting kicked off their platforms and things. Some of that legitimate, but you know, this wouldn't solve that. And they don't care. They want to just punish them for doing that. And then if you look on the left, a lot of them want to reform antitrust law in general to punish big businesses in general. And they're sort of using tech as a test case, you know, because they know people are mad at tech companies. They know it's easy to drum up fear and hatred of them. So it's like, okay, like they want to change, you know, how mergers are done. They want to change. I mean, this is only one of like six or seven bills in Congress right now being considered about this that would change the way we do antitrust law to put consumers not at the forefront anymore. And I think Democrats are really using this as a way to be like, okay, if we can do this with tech companies, then we'll start doing all these other ones. You even see like Elizabeth Warren and people start to already let that mask slip and just be like, next, we're going after grocery stores. Next, we're going after this, this, and this. So,
Catherine Tingle.
You know, if I may, one of the things that shows how out of touch the Congress, you know, congressional leaders are, and this has bipartisan backing, even if it's going to split along partisan lines if and when it comes up for a vote, is, you know, Amazon Prime has about 75 million households in America out of about 125,000 households in America total. Amazon Prime is in half of the households in the country. It is fabulously popular and successful with consumers. It is what made, essentially, Amazon is what made the lockdown, the pandemic, bearable. And you have a bunch of idiots in Congress going right at that to say, you know what the real problem is that you can buy a $5 Amazon basic belt instead of a $7 one by some Chinese manufacturer. This is going to explode in Congress's face in a way which I think will be very instructive to, you know, just how out of touch the political classes with how people actually live their lives.
I'm just going to say that my family here, you know, they may not like to talk about politics, but you know what? They love Amazon. My mom has even discovered how to shop on Amazon, which is a big deal because she's not very tech savvy. But, you know, Amazon, yes, I can vouch, very popular with normie America.
Yeah, so I want to ask you about that, Catherine. One of the weirder arguments to me being made in favor of the current antitrust push is that it's a way to combat inflation, right? So you have folks like Elizabeth Warren out there bemoaning that big grocery has consolidated, leading to higher prices and less consumer choice at the grocery store. Similarly, you've got President Biden saying, you know, it's big meat, right? The major beef and pork and poultry producers, they're the problem, and they're using their market power to overcharge grocery stores and ultimately families, which is just a transparently ridiculous argument that even a lot of left-leaning economists have rejected. And along those lines, this bill could end up targeting genuinely popular services like Amazon Prime. This all seems sort of crazy to me that on the one hand, they are saying, well, look, we're doing this for the consumers to reduce the prices. And on the other hand, they're saying there is absolutely no way that we are going to care about pro-consumer policy anymore, because if we did, this bill just wouldn't work.
Yeah, I think
make sense of this for me.
I cannot make it make sense, as the kids online say. But I will say, I think this is a lagging narratives problem. So for a long time, the way that people understood the role of antitrust, the concern about monopolies or, you know, large, powerful corporations, was that and this was like my childhood, you know, grade school understanding, middle school understanding of why we have antitrust was, OK, so they get big, and maybe they get big partially by selling cheap stuff until their competitors go out of business. And then once they have us by the balls, I guess I did not think of it that way when I was in elementary school, but like once they have us by the balls, they will raise the prices. And
once
so
they have grabbed our earlobes in an ornery, teachery manner.
Yeah. I did go to Virginia public schools, but it was past the earlobe grabbing phase of teacher discipline, thankfully. But the idea that always looming right around the corner with any large, powerful corporation is that extortionary raise in prices, that sort of article of faith, is what shapes still this idea that somehow, even when by all measures these companies are pro-consumer and are reducing prices, we just believe that at some point they will turn. They will, you know, rip off the mask. They will throw back the cloak, and then they will start charging us infinity dollars for the same services, and we will be powerless at their hands because the competition has been eliminated. I think that's the story. I think that's the story that people vaguely believe. I think that's the story that people have in the back of their minds. And that's why they let Elizabeth Warren say things like the grocery stores are just jacking up the prices for funsies, because we've already been told, well, that's what big, powerful corporations do. Never mind that there's actually a lot of competition in the grocery space. Never mind that the profit margin of grocery stores is like 1.5%. You know, none of those facts can take a dent out of this story that we have told ourselves about why we need antitrust, even though it doesn't match up with our reality, which is a very pro-consumer reality.
I think it also, you know, you're right that it's a lagging indicator. This is all coming out of what was called, you know, a couple of years ago, was dubbed the hipster antitrust movement, who are, you know, followers of Louis Brandeis, a Supreme Court justice who before that was a big attorney who like fought a lot of antitrust stuff. And he had a phrase, you know, that Tim Wu, who's one of the leaders of this intellectual movement of antitrust stuff, about the curse of bigness. And Brandeis did not care about consumer outcomes. He cared about, he came from a family. He was born and raised in Louisville, Kentucky, and his father was a mid-sized merchant. He wanted to have a lot of mid-sized firms, and he was freaked out by large national corporations and brands that were coming online in the teens and the 20s. And he equated a good outcome with having a lot of smaller firms that generally fucked over consumers or did not offer as good prices or as much variety. It was later, you know, the Chicago School are the ones who really talked about consumer outcomes and benefits for consumer being the real test of whether or not a monopoly is a bad thing, or large market share is bad, or bigness is bad. And that's the intellectual battleground. The hipster antitrust people, and Elizabeth Warren does this, they always point to how Robert Bork, who, you know, became a horrible monster in many ways after he didn't make it onto the Supreme Court, he had written a very influential book called The Antitrust Paradox, where he said, consumer harm is the real question here. And when that's not happening, there's no reason to break up big firms. And they link, you know, well, you know, Robert Bork was terrible. He wanted women to have back alley abortions. And here he is on antitrust. So there's a lot of kind of head work going on here that is all in the service of getting away from any empirical test about whether or not consumers are better off in a given economic system.
Liz, so much of this just seems like politicians are big mad at big tech. Like, they don't care what the particular mechanism is that they use. They just want to go after large tech companies any way that they can. And so, right, I say, like, if all you have is progressive antitrust legislation, everything looks like a company that needs to be broken up, right? And so this bill, as you've said, abandons any pretense of being a generalized antitrust bill. It is just focused on a couple of large tech companies. And I guess I don't understand that focus in this environment where actually those companies are pretty popular, right? Where people like Amazon Prime and where people think those services are great in a lot of, at least in a lot of cases. Like, it made sense to me when politicians went after confusing cell phone contracts or 1-900 numbers that targeted children and like ran up their parents' bills, or even video game loot boxes, because people hated those things. Now, I don't think those pushes, I was against that, but like people hated those products. But people love Amazon Prime, right? In Ohio, people think Amazon Prime is delivering for them where Joe Biden isn't. And yet,
delivering
politicians, yes, literally delivering, right? And yet politicians are going after it anyway. And I don't understand what's in it for them, right? What is the political incentive here? What is the allure of going after big tech? What did big tech do to hurt America's politicians?
Well, I think, you know, the extremely online class on both sides has lots of grievances with big tech. So it is very popular amongst like a certain segment of very loud base of both sides. I think also, like Nick said, you know, they're just out with what the average people want, or they don't care because they know that your average voter probably actually isn't going to like learn about the intricacies of what they did and what they did with the antitrust law and how they, if something's suddenly gone from Amazon, they're not going to know that it's because of this, you know, thing that Amy Klobuchar introduced. And politicians have grievances with these companies. They are mad at these companies because these companies have been not, you know, begging them for different things. They have been coming before them in all these hearings that Congress keeps calling them into, and the CEOs haven't been groveling, you know. They've been just sort of asserting themselves and talking back. Amazon's even talked back to Elizabeth Warren and various people on Twitter and pushed back on things. And I think that part of it is just that a lot of the people in Congress just don't like that these companies are big and you know, do what they want, then don't listen to them and aren't fearful enough about them and sort of like, you will respect my authority kind of thing. And then lastly,
go
ahead, Nick.
They also, you know, I mean, you know, the Republicans, you know, say that Facebook and Twitter cost Trump the election in 2020. Democrats say that Facebook cost Hillary Clinton the election in 2016. So, you know, that's at the root of a lot of this.
That's bipartisanship.
That, you know, each party, you know, feels like they were robbed by this group. And it's also a question of controlling, you know, media. And this is not to be in the tank for something like Facebook or Twitter, which have bad moderation problems as far as I'm concerned. But, you know, they have, you know, they have big enemies on both sides because politicians are incapable of controlling what is actually being said on those platforms. So they're going to try and blow up the platforms.
Yeah, it
and
does like seem Nick really said, personal to me. Like,
I was going to say, and like Nick said, you know, the hipster antitrust people are all now in the Biden administration. Like two of the main people, Tim Wu, who is now on his White House Economic Council, and Lina Khan, who's now at the FTC. And they've been people that have just been wanting to stick it to big businesses all along and get this new version of antitrust. Now they're in there and they get the chance with tech companies. So,
yeah, it's almost like politicians view tech as a threat to their prestige and power somehow. Like there's a lot of weird high profile anxiety going on here. And on that note, let's hear from a backer. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp Online Therapy. Check out betterhelp.com/roundtable. Life is full of stressors. It doesn't matter who you are or what you have. Your life is probably stressful. Yes. You may not be feeling down and out and depressed or like you're at a total loss, but if your stress is high, your temper is shorter than usual, or even if you're starting to feel the strain of any of your relationships, you could probably use the chance to unload. Unload the stress and get it out. Talk to someone who's completely unbiased about your life, someone who isn't going to judge you or take sides on anything. When there are things you can't tell anyone or feel like you can't unload to family and friends, you need to unload it. And that's what therapy can be. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can start communicating with your therapist in under 48 hours. Unload the stressors and get some unbiased feedback. You'd be pretty surprised at what you might gain from it. See if it's for you. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp, and the Reason Roundtable listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/roundtable. That's BETTRHELP.com/roundtable. Okay, so next up, we have our listener question. Dave writes to give a bunch of delightful compliments to folks on the show, and then to ask a question about school choice. He says he will try to be brief. And then, of course, he isn't. Dave, I can relate. Basically, Dave worries about the criteria that parents would use to choose schools in an environment where school choice was widespread, right? So you'd have safety and academics and after-school activities and all of that. And then he writes, specialty classes and opportunities would be one of them, but wouldn't many parents desire for their children to be in an environment where people shared the same values or had other children like them? Whether this would be based on race or class or political affiliation or some other trait in our hyper-polarized environment, could you imagine a world where parents and students self-segregate? For example, in a middle-class town, all the right-leaning parents, that would be politically right-leaning, send their kids to school A, while the lefties send their kids to school B. Once that segregation begins, Dave worries, as it has in many schools already today, it snowballs. It becomes difficult to reverse. So Dave says he firmly believes in the merits of individual choice, but he also wants to see a world where children of all backgrounds interact and learn from each other's experiences. Sounds good to me. Diversity of class, race, and thought are essential for this to take place and to stop worrying about the trend of polarization. While they've proven inordinately bad at providing equal opportunities to all students, public schools do in many cases force students of different backgrounds into the same building. That has benefits. So Dave wonders if he is being misanthropic here. Maybe he's just overlooking something. Catherine, I want to go to you first. This tees up School Choice Week. What do you think? Are there downsides to school choice? Would it lead to bad segregation and polarization?
Yeah. First of all, happy National School Choice Week to those who celebrate. I am among you.
This is huzzah.
This is the week where a bunch of different groups come together, including Reason, to just kind of put a spotlight on the value of school choice. And I personally feel very strongly about this issue. So I am always happy to have an occasion to bring together a bunch of content. In fact, we will have a video that will probably be live by the time this podcast goes up about the role that transportation plays in school choice, which I think is something that's undercovered. It was a fun video to work on. I'm excited about it. But let me get to Dave's letter. I think even though Dave has tried to be very judicious in his letter, he has still overestimated what the current system, or generically speaking, a public system, is getting right. Public schools are incredibly homogenous, and when they are large public schools, subcultures within them separate out and become homogenous internally. Putting everyone in the same big building is the bluntest of instruments, and the reason we use it is because all other instruments, all other tools snap immediately under the pressure of parental preferences. People have very strong preferences for their children. They also... and this is something that economists have studied for a long time, which I think is a fascinating topic. Even people with very, 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 very small preferences will end up self-segregating in a way that is self-reinforcing in other areas, not just education. So this is in housing. This is in terms of their workplace. This is in terms of, you know, other kinds of educational choices. Many, many people value diversity in the way that Dave described, and some people will select schools that prioritize having diversity, but people value lots of other things as well. And revealed preferences already show that even in what should be a homogenizing and diverse public system, people find ways to build and sustain schools that are quite homogenous. I don't think that a system with more choice would make that problem notably worse. And I think it would make many, 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 many other problems better. Now, Dave has acknowledged this in his question. He says, let's assume that the marketplace created by choice raises quality for all, allows people's needs to be met, you know, gratifies diverse preferences. It is true that you will wind up with homogeneous schools. We currently have homogeneous schools. The history of public schooling has been a history of a battle against the homogeneity of schools, sometimes imposed by law, sometimes imposed by custom. It's not a battle we're winning right now. And so I guess my feeling is that the clear upsides of school choice on a variety of other dimensions overcome that particular concern.
Nick, I know you've been a big backer of school choice for a while. I think it's also fair to say, correct me if I'm wrong, you value intellectual and cultural diversity. So I was thinking about this. I'll let that stand.
Yeah,
all right, good. So I was thinking about this just in the context of the news industry, where people have, in many ways, a lot more choices than they used to. I mean, when I grew up, we had two local papers, and then it was sometimes possible, though not always, to get big national papers like the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, USA Today. But it was actually difficult to do so unless you waited a week and went to the college library. And I think what you've seen in the news industry is that as people have had a lot more choice, in many cases, not all, but in many cases, they have kind of self-selected into ideological bubbles. How would you make sure that a school choice regime didn't lead to ideological or cultural bubbling?
Yeah, I wouldn't. And, you know, partly because I was a victim of school choice as exercised by my parents. I grew up in Middletown, New Jersey, which had, at the time that I was growing up, the teachers in Middletown were the highest paid in the state of New Jersey, which always paid its teachers more than most states. They had great public schools, and my parents, for reasons that were only revealed very late in his life by my father, insisted that we go to a subpar Catholic school because that was very important to them. So I went to a school that was, you know, theologically homogenous. It turned out that actually the Catholic schools, you know, both my grammar school, St. Mary's, and my high school, Mater Dei, Mother of God in New Monmouth, New Jersey, was more diverse class-wise than the public schools for some interesting reasons. But it was very much a monoculture based around religious instruction and theological, you know, kind of consistency. Academically, it was terrible. It was definitely third rate compared to the crappiest public schools. There were a bunch in my hometown. So, you know, like I suffered from my parents' school choice in terms of academics. I could have learned more at the public schools. I also gained certain things. But to get to the main point of what the writer is talking about, and I think this is important, you should not expect the school to be the entire world of the kid. Where I met people both from public schools who were also Protestant and Jewish, and there were a lot of all, you know, most of my town is that. It was in Boy Scout troops. It was in Little League baseball. It was in soccer. It was in other activities. And one of the problems with schools right now, and this goes back to people, you know, like way in the past, but, you know, sociologists like Irving Goffman talk about schools as total institutions. We approach them as if they are the limit of the world of the people who inhabit them, you know, particularly students. And that's a broken model. It's a dumb model that comes along with saying that, you know, everybody has to go through public education, everybody has to learn the same thing, everybody has to dress the same way, et cetera, et cetera. One thing that school choice would do, I think, is ironically, as it gives people more power to say, this is where my kids are going, or kids to say, this is where I want to go, it would actually limit the expectations put on them. And it would create a better society because people would be looking for education in schools and other types of experiences elsewhere. I think that would be a better outcome.
Liz, what's school choice week like in Normie, Ohio? You worried about polarization?
No, I think just to kind of go with what Nick was saying, actually, I think that, you know, parents are going to select for different things when they are selecting schools. So you might end up, yes, with like once if you in this world, you might end up with one school that is known for its athletics. So more good athletes go there. You might end up with one school that's known for, you know, being outstanding at certain sorts of academics. So they go there. But as that's happening, you're going to create different kinds of diversity that may not have been created from within, you know, just pulling from within a certain geographic area. Like Nick mentioned, you might create, you know, more class diversity or just, you know, other kinds of diversity, more religious diversity, more ethnic diversity by parents each, you know, preferencing what is important to them in their schools, which inevitably is going to be very different array of things for different parents.
I want to add, I also wish now as a fan of the show Euphoria, I would have liked to have gone to the high school that Euphoria takes place.
I think all of us would like to go to high schools from various shows on TV. Like, why are they always outside? It's incredible. I guess all high schools on TV are in California, even the ones that are in
that's
Minnesota.
Pretty much it.
I do want to say there's one other piece to this that I think explains part of the parental rage of the last couple of years. It's a little bit what Nick was saying. The fact that schools have increasingly become these totalizing institutions, they've become this one-stop shop for everything in childhood. In many places, that includes nutrition, it includes healthcare, it includes, you know, not only education.
Enrichment activities
but warehousing.
Of all sorts. Yeah.
It also includes, you know, in some cases, it includes psychological services, which often end up redounding negatively on families. There's like, they, you know, arguably public schools are the most successful sort of stealth imposition of a centralized bureaucracy of childhood, you know, a real like government provided service. And the fact that that whole system was built in a way that allowed like Randy Weingarten and five assholes to just take it away for years from some families. And then they were like, why are you so angry? We're just schools. Like, why do you want us to do everything and be everything to you? It's like, because you insisted on doing everything and being everything to us. You built a whole system around being at the heart of everyone's lives. And now you're mad that A, people want to fight over that thing where it's winner takes all. And B, you're mad that people want you to provide those services. So I think there is, again, you know, there's always a flip side to the large, diverse institution and many smaller, less diverse institutions. A diversity even of smaller institutions is almost certainly a better way.
I don't think I want to go to any movie high school. I want to not have gone.
You don't want to go to Hogwarts
to high school at all, I think is really what I wish for.
You want to homeschool?
We do need to move.
You want to go
here
to the Adam Lanza homeschool?
I want to go to the one.
I
want to
have do a whole
Buffy
segment.
Buffy the Vampire Slayer's high school.
All right, now you've convinced me. Okay, before we go, I do want to touch on one final thing that is happening in Washington this week because we are on a clock here. We are going to call this very brief segment "Insane in the Ukraine." Joe Biden is considering deploying to Europe and moving warships.
Ukrainiacs.
Joe Biden
do it.
is thinking about moving warships around and deploying troops to Europe in response to Russian saber rattling around Ukraine. All this still up in the air. We don't know exactly what's going to happen, but the short version is a lot of folks expect that Russia will attack Ukraine soon. And so Biden is considering making some preliminary moves here, as the New York Times reports this morning, as President Putin has ramped up his threatening actions towards Ukraine. That's President Putin of Russia. And talks between American and Russian officials have failed to discourage him. The administration is now moving away from its do not provoke strategy. So, Catherine, yay or nay on sending troops to Europe? Should the U.S. stick with a do not provoke strategy, or is there something else Team Biden should be doing as we enter year two?
It's really not clear that us provoking has a lot to do with anything one way or the other. I mean, this is a little bit of an act of hubris, I think, on the part of policymakers in the U.S. to think that this is about us at all. I mean, we could make it about us, just as we could make conflict in Taiwan about us. And perhaps we will in both of these cases. But, you know, I do think this is an opportunity which Biden will definitely not take to change the way the U.S. behaves in terms of being a global hegemon. This is a moment when we could not do the damn thing. I think we will probably half-assedly do the damn thing. That tends to be our MO, basically in all aspects of governance, but especially in foreign policy. And, you know, I don't deny that the threat is extremely real from Putin to the people of Ukraine, as well as perhaps to the broader sphere of Russia, just again, as the threat is very real in Taiwan from China. To say the U.S. cannot profitably intervene here, we have no clear strategy, we have no clear way forward that makes the situation better and not worse, is not to say that those problems don't matter, simply that we are not the players who can solve them. I am not the hardest core non-interventionist. I'm a teeny bit squishy. I've probably listened, you know, to one too many drunken conversations with foreign policy, you know, libertarian realists and their ilk.
This is the Weekly Standard.
That's right.
Right?
It's
Weekly Standard water cooler.
The Weekly Standard. So I'm definitely a neocon in disguise who's a sleeper cell at Reason or whatever. But in this,
are you really in disguise? Like, take your mask off. I want to do that. Let's do the Scooby-Doo
routine.
I'm a lizard.
She's just waiting for that phone call that calls out a playing card.
I'm definitely a lizard person. No, I think it is very hard for me, a layman, or even me, a reader of news who is slightly more informed than the average layman, to see a way forward for us with respect to Ukraine that doesn't make the situation worse. If Biden can see a way, I guess he's going to try, but I doubt he'll succeed.
You know, we had the moment, first off, you know, we had the moment when the Cold War ended to rip up a lot of the institutions are heavily reformed then, that were formed to fight the Cold War, NATO, you know, being front and center in this particular instance. And while Putin is responsible for all of the bad things he does and possibly some of the good things, there's no question that the aggressive expansion of NATO after the end of the Cold War is a provoking factor here, because and NATO was designed to contain the Soviet Union, but we kept it going in order to contain a dying, lumbering wreck like Russia under Putin. This is the most challenging thing, I think, even to non-interventionists, because if you care about humanitarian issues, the U.S. should pull back from being the global hegemon in the way that we have tried and failed massively in the past 20 years. We were right to get out of Afghanistan, and that does not make Afghanistan a better place. We should not be getting involved in European battles. And this is clearly and fully something that Europe should be dealing with front and center. And if NATO exists, it should be as, you know, it should be completely different. It should be a different franchise. It should be the Baltimore Ravens, not the Cleveland Browns. It needs to be completely rethought. And I hope that Biden actually has the capacity to rethink and to follow through on some of the stuff that Trump talked about, which is, you know, we cannot be the police, you know, we can't be the global policeman, and we shouldn't be, both because we can't afford it, but also we're not good at it. But I think only bad things are going to come out of all of this.
Okay, while we are talking about endings, let's see if we can move toward one for this show. And let's go to our cultural recommendations. Nick, I know you just told us about your feelings about war in the Ukraine. Let's start with you anyway.
Well, you know, where I am an internationalist, without reservation, comes to the arts and particularly a study of modernism. And what I've been reading this past week is a collection of film essays. It's called A Modernist Cinema, Film Art from 1914 to 1941, and it's edited by Scott Klein and Michael Valdez-Moses, who is a sometimes Reason contributor. He's also married to my ex-wife, and I spent Christmas with him and with Catherine Gillespie, who now teach at Chapman University. A Modernist Cinema, Film Art from 1914 to 1941 is fascinating because it takes seriously the idea of modernism, a broad-based arts movement, you know, a kind of make it new movement that was very international and reinvigorated and changed all kinds of traditional arts, but also puts movies front and center because it's the one technology and the one art form that was being formed as modernism was sweeping the globe. So it's fantastic. And Michael's essay in this in particular, which is called That Saves Them the Blessings of Civilization. It's about John Ford's Stagecoach and what he calls American vernacular modernism, is fascinating. And it's, if you are interested in the history of arts and the way that arts actually, you know, we tend up talking about things like literature as, you know, American literature, British literature, French cinema, Italian cinema, et cetera. Most art movements, and certainly the most interesting ones, are transnational. They are global. They don't care about kind of arbitrary boundaries that get put up by politics. And that is definitely true about modernism. So I just, if you have a serious interest in film history, check out A Modernist Cinema, Film Art from 1914 to 1941.
Liz, what have you been watching?
Reading, listening to, otherwise
consuming?
Basically just been reading like terrible books about babies because I've got a new baby at home. So I'm gonna cheat and go with a podcast that I just listened to.
The books are terrible, not the babies, right?
Not the babies. My baby is wonderful. But I've been listening to a podcast I just did a mini review on for an upcoming print issue. So I'm gonna cheat and go with that. It's called Operator. It's through Wondery. It's an 8-part podcast about the history of the 1-900 phone sex industry. And it is told through the biggest company was American Telnet. So it's sort of about the rise and fall of American Telnet. And it's a fascinating look at it, especially if you weren't really around to witness that, or, you know, old enough to witness sort of what was going on with that firsthand. It's interesting and fun and sexy. And, you know, you get to hear sort of some of the ridiculous inner workings of the company and what was said on the phone calls and what, you know, clients wanted and all of that kind of funny and fun stuff. But also the more sort of depressing element is that it also goes into how, you know, cops and regulators and anti-porn crusaders and all of these things were after them. And it's just the exact same playbook we've seen today with things like, you know, the classified sites like Backpage, or now with the direct to consumer sort of porn sites like OnlyFans, right down to, you know, like pressuring the credit card companies or just pressuring everybody who did business with these phone companies, and sort of putting the pressure on Congress to ban even certain words. I didn't know that you couldn't say certain words on these phone calls, which is why they had to develop this kind of ridiculous euphemistic language around talking about sex sometimes, because some words were banned and they had regulators actually listening in to the phone sex calls to make sure that these forbidden words weren't being said. So just all around a really...
Could you say one of the forbidden words?
They didn't say specifically which words were forbidden. Ugh. I know. Or if they did,
we could have made this podcast forbidden just like that.
Yeah, I don't know if those laws are still on the books actually. But yeah, so it's just a really fun but also sort of enlightening is a, like, you know, everything old is new kind of way podcast.
Catherine, what number should we call for your recommendations?
Definitely not a 900 number for this week's recommendation, at least. I read Taste, My Life Through Food by Stanley Tucci, and it was kind of delightful, not going to lie. Now, Suderman, I know, has a little bit of some strong feelings about this man's Negroni technique, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think those
he made an internet famous Negroni at the beginning of the pandemic.
That he made all wrong.
And
very
he
wrong.
Suggested that you could use vodka.
Okay, so like not okay. Just big not okay.
Mezcal or go home.
What are you, a platonic idealist about Negronis? Leave Stanley Tucci alone. He's an Italian American.
Yeah. So the book is casual to the point of being barely a book. I mean, when I say book, I mean like my food blog from 2006 was more densely and carefully structured than this book. But
that sounds like a Wayback Machine research project.
Everybody had one then. It was fine. But it was brought to me by a friend during a earlier COVID quarantine period. And it was delivered alongside a pre-mixed cocktail. And the book came to me as a sort of act of love and hospitality. And that's the vibe of this book. There's some good Gillespian sort of Italian-American self-love, self-hate, immigration story that's both inspirational and lightly depressing. So I guess what I'm saying is read Stanley Tucci's food memoir to understand a little bit better where Nick Gillespie is coming from, not to get a Negroni recipe.
Oh, and then also watch Big Night, a fantastic food movie with him and Tony Shalhoub, who is the Anthony Quinn of his era. He plays every ethnic except that which he actually is. But Big Night is a great food movie with Stanley Tucci, Isabella Rossellini, and Tony Shalhoub.
Big Night is such a great movie, and I remember watching it when I was young and a picky eater who had not been exposed to the world of truly great food and high-end restaurants. And in some ways, it was my first exposure, and I remember thinking, "Wow, the world of like foodie food might actually be interesting to me." And it became, in some ways, almost a little bit. I think coming after watching that movie, it became a little bit aspirational. For me, and I wanted to understand like what that food was like in real life, not just in the movies. I have not been watching a movie recently, though I have been watching something based on a movie, The Book of Boba Fett, which is a series on Disney Plus, because, as noted, I am a former Star Wars lunchbox haver, so I could not resist this series, and I have to say it is totally, incredibly, just okay. And that's kind of a problem, because the character of Boba Fett is a character who had such a cool mystique, in part because you knew so little about him. And now that you know a bunch of stuff about him, he's just kind of bland and he's not that interesting anymore. And so by being just fine and just okay and sort of watchable, this show, I think, has robbed the Star Wars franchise of a little bit of its mystique. Because Boba Fett was a weird bounty hunter who had like six lines, maybe, one of which was, "He's no good to me, dead." And that was it. And that was all you knew was he said that, he had a scar on his helmet, and he wanted Han Solo. And I think we were better off not knowing. And with that, I will end this week's podcast. Matt Welch will be back with weird baseball character names that are definitely made up next week. Thanks for listening.